KBOO Community Radio is hiring a public affairs director to manage public affairs programming, ensuring that it is of the highest quality and consistent with the KBOO programming charter. For this 32 hours position, we are looking for someone with production experience, experience in community radio, who has communication and training skills, and the ability to work independently in a fast-paced work environment. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Deadline to apply is Friday, October 25th at 5 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/PADHire2019.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of LARCH Benefit Celebration on Saturday, October 19th at 5:30 p.m. at the University of Portland. LARCH Portland is a nonprofit organization that builds relationships between people with and without intellectual disabilities and promotes a community of belonging for all. The LARCH annual benefit celebration features performing artists with and without disabilities, auctions, food and drink, and more. Again, that's the LARCH benefit celebration on Saturday, October 19th at 5:30 p.m. at the University of Portland, 5000 North Willamette Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. This is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of justice and freedom. Let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, that we will be able to live with people as our brothers and sisters.
And good morning. That is, of course, the wisdom of Martin Luther King Jr., his description of the beloved community. My name is John Shuck, and this is the beloved community. You hear it every second Friday from 9 to 10 on KBOO, and you can go to archive site, kboo.fm/beloved community, to hear previous programs, as well as my website, progressivespirit.net. Have a different kind of program today, an unusual one, in which I just want to talk with a friend of mine here. He's a friend of KBOO, who's been a friend of KBOO for a long, long time. His name is Per Fogering, and I'll bet many of you know him. You hear his show on Thursdays, I think, what is it, second and fourth?
Yeah, first and third.
First and third Thursdays, usually, although now he's had it on a couple of times. Fight the Empire is the name of the program. But I found, or he showed me, a novel that he had written about 4 years ago called Jack Maloney's Century. And I thought, I wanted to do a show about peak oil. And I thought of bringing back, James Howard Kunstler, and I still may yet. I had him once a few years ago, but then I thought, well, Pear's right here. And I think, well, let's, and it would be a good opportunity to talk to Pear. Every now and then we meet in the lobby and we talk about various things. And I thought, I'm going to get him on the radio to talk about him. And so, welcome, Pear.
Yeah. Happy to be here.
All right. Really glad.
You got me up this early, so here I am.
All right. And so I want to talk about this novel. I want to talk about peak oil and the war movement and the empire. This novel, if you haven't picked it up yet, is called Jack Maloney's Century. And this is from the back cover. What happened to America when young Jack Maloney jumped ship in New York? In the year 2000, the United States was the world's great power. When Jack died 80 years later, the United States was in pieces, and his long life came to an end in a place called Cascadia. Jack Maloney grew up in Derry, in British-occupied Ireland. One night he helped some friends lob a mortar round into an army camp, and the IRA got him out of town. From Ireland to a job on a cruise ship to New York, Chicago, the Great Plains, and Oregon, Jack lived through a dangerous time in history. Gone were cheap oil. banks, and mighty war machines. Now wars were fought by roving bands of armed people on foot. Old nations broke apart, and new ones were born in rebellion. Nature itself fought back at human folly. As always, life depended on good land and water and people to do the work. I guess we would call what the style of this novel a dystopia?
Well, it's sort of a mixed. It's mixed.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people do survive and they sort of come out the other end.
Uh-huh.
And actually, I'm working another novel now that's a little more dystopian. But anyway, yeah, but people, you know, it doesn't mean it's not a doom and gloom thing. It's not one of these things where everybody is out on this, I don't know, what is that, Roadrunner kind
like,
of thing.
Like Walking Dead.
Yeah, no, it's not of that. Not that. These are people trying to do their best. And, yeah, gee, a little interruption here. I noticed in your opening with Martin Luther King, he talks about Montgomery.
Uh-huh.
And I think just the other day, Montgomery elected a black mayor.
Oh, is that right?
First time in his history. Of course, that was the capital of the, you know, the Confederacy. And that's where Martin Luther King was a minister, and the whole bus boycott and all that. And they just elected a black mayor.
How about that?
Jackson, Mississippi's had one for quite a while. They're doing a lot of revamping in Jackson, Mississippi, I understand.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to get talk to you a little bit about, because a novel, sometimes with novels we can be speculative about how we might possibly see the future, so or what is coming for us, and really one of the major deals here is this concept called peak oil, and this is something I didn't really know about until I watched a movie called The End of Suburbia that came out in 2003, and it featured Michael Rupert, who you know I want to talk about, as well as Richard Hindberg and James Howard Koenstler, who I'd mentioned, and Matt Simmons, and some others talking about this concept of peak oil, and a number of them had written books at that time. Koenstler wrote The Long Emergency, and then Hindberg had The Party's Over. That was my favorite book with the cover. I had the picture of a gas nozzle pointed at his head.
Yeah, right,
Party's
yeah.
Over, you know. And so we were talking about peak oil, and gosh, you read these books, and you think, it's going to happen. And so let me ask you. Tell me, what are the basics? Well, what is peak oil, and why are we not talking about it so much anymore?
Well, why we're not, that's a good question. But when you think about it, you know, the oil that's in the ground took millions of years to get there. And humanity has used up about half of it in the last 250 years. And the other half really can't be used because you're running out of sort of the place to store all of the toxic residue, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So basically the oil era is coming to an end, you know. So it's like we've got this great inheritance of energy, and you have to ask, what have we done with it? Have we used it for a useful purpose? I'd say it's very mixed. We sort of created a lot of trash, a lot of garbage, you know, a lot of buildings and things that may never be used. Just think about that. The jail they built up there in North Portland and trying to figure out, now they're going to tear it down or something.
Yeah.
But anyway, with peak oil, you know, it's like the idea was that that the supply would start running out, that at some point you get less oil than the year before. And when that happens, as oil gets scarcer, the price goes up. And the price keeps going up and up and up until everything just kind of falls apart. Well, that was the original theory, you know, like a bell curve thing.
It was, what was a guy named Hubbert, right? The Hubbert curve or the Hubbert peak.
Hubbert's peak, yes.
Yeah.
And but what happened, actually oil did peak around the year 2005. But then along came fracking. And everybody knows what a horrible process that is, what it does to the environment. But it's a way of scraping the bottom of the barrel a little more efficiently. And so that added to the so-called production. Well, there's nobody's producing oil. They're just depleting it.
Okay.
You know, they're mining it, basically. And so this is a different way of mining the oil. Because of the very process, it does not last as long as a regular oil well. You know, those go on for decades. And you know, a fracked well, you get an initial boost in production, but then it fades away pretty fast after a few years. So you have to keep drilling more and more wells, hopefully around spots where you do have oil. So the whole thing is like we've got a temporary boost out of this fracking, but it's not going to last. In fact, apparently the overall production is peaking there too.
Right. So, and when the technicality of I learned from peak oil is it's really the peak of the rate of production. So the idea when they first came out was Hubbard's peak that the United States itself peaked around 1970. Mm-hmm. And then Hubbard thought it'd be around 2000, perhaps, but it ended up being a little bit later, and he didn't. And all the technology of fracking didn't happen, but the rate of production. And so you hear in the news, the Wall Street Journal even says, "Oh, U.S. is exporting oil," or this kind of stuff, and it's really not true at all.
No, it's not. We are exporting oil, but we're also importing oil at the same time.
Yeah, we need about 18 million barrels of oil a day.
I think so. Yes.
And the best that we produce is around what, 8 or 9 or 10? I'm not sure. Somewhere.
I think it could be that the oil we import, it depends on what kind of refineries you have.
Yeah.
Not every refinery handles every kind of oil. Some handle the heavy oil or the light oil, whatever. And so we are a net importer of oil,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
And so,
which makes the reason why our military is all around the world,
mm-hmm.
making sure that the supply lines are open.
But then you're in this situation where you can't use the oil either because it's wrecking the environment. So these two things are happening at the same time, you know, and it's. Just the very process of, you know, the first oil well was in Pennsylvania back in 1859,
mm-hmm.
and they struck oil at 69 feet,
huh.
you know, and then you had all these gushers in Texas and Oklahoma, you know, you sink a pipe into the ground and all the pressure shoots his oil up into the sky and, you know, real easy to get at. Well, then, you know, then they sort of moved to deeper wells, offshore Gulf of Mexico, and then fracking. So the whole process of getting the oil gets more and more expensive, you know, over the years.
And more exotic places like the Arctic, which you can
mm-hmm.
perhaps more easily get to when the ice melts.
Well, and then, you know, then you see what's happening to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this the very fact of using the oil is what's caused all the climate chaos. You know, we haven't experienced as much as other countries have. You know, there's islands in the Pacific that are being inundated. You know, they will be no more. People are moving to some other place, you know. And, well, right now here in this country, we've got these horrendous hurricanes. They're more frequent. They're stronger. There's a bigger flow of water. More rain is falling. And that's going to continue, going to get worse, you know, plus the rising sea levels. So really, this is kind of a real bind, you know. It's like we...
On then, both sides, the input and the output.
Right. Well, you know, that was a very interesting book that came out, The Limits to Growth.
Okay, yeah.
I've
heard of that book. I'm not sure. I'm thinking of the author, but I don't remember who
that
is.
Well, it was a team of writers.
Team of art, okay.
Well, it was Dennis Meadows and his wife, Donella. And then there was a team of people from MIT, I think, and they sort of had a computer model of the world economy. And they sort of put all these different factors into it, sort of plotted out what might happen, you know. And all the scenarios sort of broke down eventually. And they didn't mean to be predictive about the future, but some of their scenarios have pretty much tracked with what is going on now, you know. And they had, there were two limits to growth. One was the limit of the oil you can get out of the ground, which is falling. Also, there's a limit of what they call the disposal sites, you know. That is limited, too, and we see that happening right now. You know, you can't just keep dumping stuff into the ocean or into the atmosphere. It's going to come back at you.
Yes, it is. Per Fogering is my guest. We're talking about the concept of peak oil, and his novel, Jack Maloney's Century, is leading us into this conversation. Let's go back to the novel a second, because it's really based on the idea of when oil begins to become more scarce and realizing that how much of everything. We might even borrow from the Bible that we live and move in oil and have our being in oil itself, everything we can think of, and of course our entire economy. So tell me about this novel. How did you decide to write it?
I don't know. I'm not sure how I actually got started, but it was kind of tricky because it starts in the past, and then at some point it gets into the future.
Yeah.
And so anyway, it starts in the past. Jack Maloney grows up in Derry, which is in British-occupied Ireland, the northern part. And, you know, he's a young kid, about 18 or 19, and he helps some IRA guys lob a few mortar rounds. There's a British army camp called the Piggeries. And so the IRA, you know, of course, the Brits are running around frantically trying to track down the, you know, the attackers. And they bury the mortar tube in an old cabbage patch and put cabbage heads on top of it. And the IRA gets them out of town. So they sort of get him in England, and then they get him into Holland. He gets a job on a cruise ship. So he's a waiter on this cruise ship. And in the year 2000, there's what they call a millennium cruise, or people who think that, you know, big things will happen in the year 2000.
Yeah, Y2K, as I remember. Or the second coming of Jesus.
The second coming, right. And so there's this one family, the Falco family. They are on this cruise, and they're... that's where Jack meets his future wife, is Mr. and Mrs. Falco and their son and daughter. And they sort of strike up a little bit of romance on the ship, but then, you know, the cruise is over, and Jack decides to jump ship in New York. So he kind of puts on several layers of clothes, and he's got his little... pack stuff in his pockets, and he's got his button accordion, which he takes with him wherever he goes. And he heads up to the Bronx. He was given a place, an Irish tavern that he could find help with. So he winds up in this Irish tavern, and they help him get a job demolishing apartments for a builder. So he's doing that, and he's playing music at these music sessions at the tavern. And then he gets a letter from Barbara. She can't stand living out on Long Island anymore. Her deal is that, you know, they grew up Catholic, but her father got converted to some kind of evangelistic Protestant group, and he won't pay for her college unless she goes to a Bible college someplace. So she's 17, and she's going to leave home. So he helps her find a place in this rooming house he lives in the Bronx, and gets her a room there. And he actually gets her a job. They demolish apartments together, and they're demolishing one on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and they see this plane flying low over the Hudson River. Well, a few minutes later, that plane crashes into the World Trade Center about 8 miles away in Manhattan. And so anyway, after a while, Jack and Barbara, they fall in love, and they get married. And then they go to Chicago because for some, you know, there's a big lookout for terrorists after the 9/11 thing. And actually, some Irish guys did get deported, you know. They got caught up in all this. So Jack and Barbara go to Chicago. Another contact there is this a priest who's running a kind of a rehab program for in the Chicago rehabbing apartment. So there's a whole group of young kids who do that. So they join that. So in Chicago for a while. And that's when the Gulf War begins. But then they decide to leave Chicago, and they land in South Dakota. In Chicago, they meet this Father Pete. He's a Catholic priest. He just got back from Guatemala. And he's inherited this little homestead in South Dakota from an aunt. And so they go out there to look it over. And it's this little house, a big yard and everything. And so they move out there.
And this is still kind of in real time, right? This isn't quite the future yet, or it's
not
close.
Yet, not
we're
yet.
Getting right to it, though. Yeah, the Gulf War, as you say, is still going.
And then Father Pete, he goes off on a trip. He has to go back to Guatemala. He goes to Guatemala and comes back with his own bride, this Mayan Indian woman named Elena. So the four of them are living in South Dakota. And that's when, and they're kind of turning their homestead into a little kind of a mini farm. And that's when the peak oil really starts to hit, you know.
Yeah. And it just, I'm going to let you finish, but I wanted to say, because it was interesting, because it seemed to me that they are already kind of practicing for it before it really happens, in a sense. Cause, you know, they are, somebody read a book title that said, Collapse Now and Avoid the Rush, you know?
Yeah, right, yeah.
You know, so they're already doing a lot of these more hands-on kinds of lower technology types of things.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead.
And so, you know, the one of the effects of peak oil is that you know, our farming is so dependent on oil. You know, one farmer with all his machinery, you know, and an unlimited amount of oil can feed, 100 people? That's the statistic I hear.
Okay.
You know, one farmer feeds 100 people. Well, that kind of farming is on its way out. Plus, it has all kinds of environmental problems, too. So, you know, how do you get more people on the land? Well, there's different ways of doing that, you know. Well, get up prison farms, you know, which is seems like a pretty traditional American way of doing things, you know, prison farms. Or you could just have hire a lot of sharecroppers, or you could break up the big farms. But they don't want to do that. Big farmers don't want to be broken up. You know, they want to get their labor. So you get you start getting these programs where people on welfare, because the economy has kind of collapsed, they are offered jobs on the farms, and they're out there in the fields picking crops by hand that used to be harvested by machinery. And so that goes on, and you know, Jack and Barbara, and they have a couple kids, a couple sons, And Pete, he's no longer Father Pete. He's left the priesthood, and they have a daughter. He and his wife have a daughter, and actually, I think the kids go through high school in South Dakota.
Yeah. That's where Patrick there is the son, and graduates from, and his brother Dan.
Right. Yes. And then so, but they wind up. Forget exactly what, but they leave South Dakota and they head west.
Head to Portland.
Right, and that's when this whole Cascadia, you know, when you have, you know, what ties a nation together? It's transportation and communication, but if you don't have the transportation, then, you know, big nations tend to split apart.
And so that's what you see, what I saw in this novel. I'm speaking, if you're just joining us, with Per Fogering. He's wrote a novel about 4 years ago, but we're talking about it now because I just discovered it and read it. Jack Maloney's Century, from, say, 1980 to 2080, I guess, or 2076.
Mm-hmm.
And the story of what happens when the energy hits, when this lifestyle that we've well, that some of us have enjoyed, I guess, for a long time, suddenly comes to an end, and how society continues on. And one of the things you talk about is really the government and how it starts to break up. People are confused. We got wars in all these different places. And I wonder, you the government kind of helps out a lot. And I often wonder, that might be an optimistic part of your novel, that the government is even there at all. But I don't know.
Well, I would think that more and more things rely on local governments.
Yeah.
You know, the federal government becomes...
That's what I was meaning. I meant the federal government.
Yeah, Washington, D.C. becomes almost like a kind of a ceremonial city or something.
Yeah.
You know, where the real, you know, politics is basically sharing what goods we have. And this is done on a state and a local level. And more and more. You know, well, just like there's one little scene where the congressman comes back, comes to Portland. You know, but he can't afford to make his visits. You know, right now, you know, our senators and Congress people, they fly back and forth from Washington all the time. But flying is sort of on its way out now, too, already. Well, look at Greta, the Swedish young lady, you know, took a sailboat mm-hmm. to this country. But, you know, people like some of these environmental activists who talk about the environment and all that, you know, they're being criticized for flying to these conferences all over the world where one airplane flight uses up as much energy and causes as much waste in the air as a whole year of driving or something like that. So I think, you know, people will not be flying much. If you don't have the oil, I think aviation is... it's disappearing, it'll, you know.
One of the silver linings around that, from my perspective, and I probably yours too, is that military will be less too in terms of all of the. I mean, they're the biggest energy user and polluter.
That's
in the,
true. Yeah.
Of 100 countries or more of all of that. So that idea of just a globalized military might change in the terms of this.
Well, I would think so. It's a terrific waste of scarce resources. You know, if the country has to choose between maintaining 800 bases around the world and keeping people warm in the winter in the Dakotas, you know, I think a lot of people would rather give up the military bases. And, you know, just the kind of war we fight, I mean, the air wars. You know, helicopters and gunships and bombers and everything, and the whole fleet, you know. Well, they say battleships are obsolete already. I don't think they use them anymore, but aircraft carriers, you know, what do they do with them? You know, they're really kind of useless. And so they, and all the naval bases are on, of course, in seaports around the world where the oceans are rising. Like Norfolk, Virginia is one of the big naval bases we have, and they are fighting a battle right now with rising sea levels, and they're talking about building seawalls around the naval base there. But so in a way, the whole military is a different kind of war. You know, you're not going to abolish war. It would be nice if you could, but it'll be a different kind of war. You know, it'll be more like what they call counterinsurgency. Insurgency,
yeah.
And counterinsurgency.
Parafoggering my guest, he's, of course, the radio show host who's been around KABU for a long time. For about 10 years, he's been doing Fight the Empire, is
yeah,
that right?
Yeah, 10 years, yeah.
I want to talk more about that and a number of other things, also about Pear's life, and give you a chance, too. This is a show about Pear, actually, all of the interesting ideas and guests that he's had on his shows, as well as this novel and Peak Oil and the Empire and all of that. And so Per and I are going to meet in secret here and plan our plot to overthrow the world. And while that's happened, we're going to play a song and take your phone call if you'd like to. Line up a few phone calls if you have a question or a thought about our future. 503-231-8187. Our phone number is 503-231-8187, and this is The Beloved Community.
Thank you. meet with you, lady, when first we met. We danced in a whirl of blue. How can my heart forget? Blue were the skies and blue were your eyes, just like the blue skirt you wore. Come back, blue lady, come back. Don't be blue anymore.
That's Frankie Yankovic and the Yanks, Blue Skirt Waltz. I chose that because in the novel, Jack plays his accordion, and that song comes
it's
up.
It's a very popular tune in the Midwest, you know, at you know, kind of Elks Club dances and stuff like that. And that particular recording is done the Marlin Sisters, and they're very interesting because they grew up in a Jewish family, the Malofsky family chorus. It was the father was a rabbi, Malofsky, and he had two sons and four daughters, and they sort of formed a family chorus. And he was studied under a very well-known rabbi, Rosenblatt. And so the Marlin Sisters, two of the Malofsky sisters, sort of branched off into pop music, and they call themselves the Marlin Sisters. And that is them singing the Blue Skirt Waltz.
Right. And Per Fogering is my guest. And his novel is called Jack Maloney's Century, from, say, 1982, 2080, as the country undergoes peak oil and we have to learn to adapt some old technologies to the new time. And in fact, that's comes up. But we're going to take a couple of phone calls. I got, is that from Beaverton? Mitch, hello. Welcome
yes.
to the community.
Thank you for featuring Pear, because Pear has been featuring other people's activist works for years on KBOO, and it's great to hear Pear being featured. And this novel of his, Jack Maloney's Century, is the first I've heard of it. Pear, has it been published already?
Kind of, yeah, by the Phantom Press. And actually, I don't like to plug Amazon, but they have a... they have a kind of a branch called Create Space, and they help people, you know, publish books on their own. And they're very good, you know, that particular branch. Well, say what you will about Amazon, this Create Space is a very nice, friendly group, you know. They help you. And so, you know, if you want to write a book and then get it into print, there are ways it can be done fairly cheaply. You know?
And is it available already?
Well, you can go on Amazon. You can just sort of do a Google search on Jack Maloney's Century, and you can order it through Create Space, or actually, if people want to order it through me, they can. But you have to email me.
You have to pay him in Oregon currency.
Well, fortunately, I have your email address because you've been a real good on the media discussion list. But do you have a website?
I don't have a website, no, but I do have a cable website, I guess, but it's sort of not very well maintained, to put it that way.
Right.
I do have an email address. It's phantom@heavennet, HEVANET.com. But yeah, if people want to contact me and send me a check, and I'll ship them a copy.
Well, terrific. I also wanted to ask you another question, because you used to be very involved in labor issues in the Bay Area, and we're kind of involved in one of those right now. And I just wanted to know if... you have been watching what's been going on with UFCW and the people that work at Fred Meyer and Safeway stores.
Well, a little bit, yeah. You know, I guess they called off the boycott. The boycott of Freddy's ended. I guess they're still bargaining, I think. Well, I was involved in San Francisco. I was involved in the newspaper strike.
Right.
Because I got a job. I was, at that time, I was a copy editor at the San Francisco Examiner. And we had a newspaper strike. I think it was 1968. And it was very interesting because that was when the new, this new computer technology was coming into being. And so we had this strike, and so there's no newspapers. The Examiner and the Chronicle were both out of production. So the local TV, KQED, which is the NPR station there, they started this sort of like a kind of like a newsroom program, where Mel Wax, who was the editor from the Chronicle, and some of the reporters would gather and they discuss the news. And they actually had a guy doing an editorial cartoon while the, so that was the first time they had this kind of combined newsroom thing on TV. You know, that started in 1968, I believe, or 66, whenever that strike was.
Right.
And we had the Examiner, we had this kind of a con artist as a news, as a gossip columnist. He called himself Freddie Francisco. And he knew every restaurant guy in town. And so for our strike kitchen, where normally a strike kitchen is, you know, sandwiches and whatever, Freddie Francisco provided a strike kitchen of catered stuff from Trader Vic's, all the fine restaurants in San Francisco.
So strikers ate well.
We did. For once, for once the strikers ate well. Anyway, yeah, with the so the strike lasted about 6 weeks, I believe, you know, and then, you know, got settled.
Well, I had a question for you with your knowledge and experience. My question that, that I called in about was why it is, you know, I am working with UFCW, and anybody who knows the band that used to back Bob Dylan, the band, they had a song called King Harvest, and that song is kind of about how working people are stuck between big labor and big bosses, and it's they have to side with labor because it's their only hope, but very frequently labor looks after their own interests before they look after their workers' interests. And I'm working for a union, UFCW, with Fred Meyer, that has basically accepted a union contract that is 20 cents above minimum wage, that amounts to below minimum wage once your union dues are deducted.
Mm-hmm.
And my question to you, Per, is why is it that after all these years of labor struggles, and we've had now 45 years of economists quantifying wage stagnation, that there hasn't been a demand by labor for access to the public's airwaves? We have eight programs where every week is This Week on Wall Street, every week is Planet Money. Planet Money is a daily program.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Every day there's Marketplace. Every day there's Investor This, Investor That. And there has I have never seen a well-paid union person make a public demand and organize on the streets in front of every public broadcasting station, including OPB, which is a statewide monopoly. I've never seen that demand raised for equal time for a program I've been pitching called Wage Slave Week, which would be free to criticize labor, free to criticize the bosses, and just present the perspective of what it's like to punch a clock and try and pay the rent.
Mm-hmm.
All right. All right, Mitch, good question. Where do
well,
you think,
you know, as far as, you know, the business page, newspapers, one paper that I worked on the at the San Francisco News Call Bulletin, we had actually, we had two labor reporters. You know, they covered the unions, and that was their beat. You don't have that anymore. Like you say, it's all business, you know, business pages.
They but what has prevented labor from making the demand?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of the labor laws have been undercut. You know, it was a lot easier to organize in the old days. You know, there's so many, there's little ways that
prepare. I write letters to the editor as a private citizen. Why can't the well-paid union people do that? I never see them writing to the Portland Tribune or the Oregonian.
I don't know. I don't know. I think they're different. You know, there are different unions. I've been in about 8 different unions in my life.
Yeah.
And some have been pretty good and some haven't been. I think one of the best unions I was in was the Newspaper Guild, you know, but others, I was also in the Teamsters and the Cab Drivers Local, and not so great, but...
Mitch, thank you for the call. We're gonna let you go. I got a couple more lined up, and good luck on that. All right, this is the beloved community, and I'm speaking with Per Fogering, and we're talking about his book, Jack Maloney's Century, about life after peak oil. And we're going to take a quick question here from Edie. Hello, Edie.
Hi. It's hard to summarize your entire life in an hour, and given that, I'm still going to ask you, could you please share the most shareable lessons and blessings from your life, and what are the main messages that you want to communicate to the world?
Well, there you go. Edie, you should be a radio announcer.
Oh, boy. Right. Well, I don't know. Well, I think when you think about it, you know, the oil that's in the ground now took millions of years to get there. And the human species has used half of that oil up in just a little over 2 centuries. And the other half really can't be used because it's killing the environment. So we're really at a crossroads where we're going to have a whole new way of living on this planet Earth. And boy, when I was a kid, I didn't realize that, you know. But it's become very apparent. And so I suppose that's one lesson I've learned is that you know, the human species is not guaranteed to survive.
There you go. You know, I'm thinking of Daniel Quinn's book, Ishmael. I don't know if you read that. You know,
no.
Just human beings, we have not lived according to the laws of nature. In fact, we're certainly not doing that now. We're consuming more than we are actually putting back. Edie, thanks for that phone call. I want to take another call here in just a second, but I want to ask you a little bit about your show, Fight the Empire. You started that, 10 years ago?
Yeah.
How did that get going, and what was your premise with that?
Well, the idea was that it just seems to me that a lot of the things that are wrong with, you know, today's world can be traced to the empires. Like, racism began out of slavery, which was created by these empires.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just one example. And I think empires are really kind of doomed. I hope they are. You know, I think they are. But they're putting up a big fight as they go down the tubes. And my first guest 10 years ago was Pepe Escobar.
Yeah.
And he's kind of a fascinating guy. He's from Brazil, but he spent a lot of time traveling around Asia. And he wrote books about the pipelines and things like that. He's quite a guy. But he's my first guest, and we talked about a rebellion going on in Baluchistan, which is kind of on the border between Pakistan and Iran. And that is... Still going on. CIA is still messing around in that part of the world, you know. But and I've had Pepe Escobar as a guest a few times. But that's sort of how the show got started. And I don't know, had some very interesting guests, you know. And you just sort of, you know, I read an article. Luckily, I'm retired, so I have a lot of time to read this interesting stuff. Because it does interest me. If it didn't interest me, I wouldn't read it. And so, you know, I read an interesting article, and I think, gee whiz, man, contact the author, see if he or she will be a guest on the show. All you can do is ask.
One of the things you talk about, it comes up in the novel, is that with the character Father Pete and coming back from Guatemala. And actually, you go there quite a bit and talking about the U.S. history there, which is pretty brutal.
Yes. Well, it began before the U.S. It began with the Spanish conquerors, you know. And so, you know, it's been a 500-year genocide against the Mayan Indians, who are still there. They survived. And in some ways, I think they will survive long after industrial civilization has faded away or transmogrified into whatever, you know. The Zapatistas in Mexico are Mayan Indians mostly, and they have. I think to me, the Zapatistas are the future.
You know, I'm thinking as things transition, and they could be very quickly. I'm thinking of Dmitry Orlov telling me about the website Deagle.com, in which he's talking about with before the decade out of a major financial collapse. The population of the United States becoming a third, these kinds of things. And as this hits and as the rest of the world starts to ignore the United States in terms of its pushing the dollar on them, I think your novel actually is really optimistic. I mean, a pessimistic thing could be, and just, you know, we'll just nuke each other before we're done.
Well, it's very interesting because there's another writer, John Michael Greer.
Yeah.
Calls himself the Arch-Druid. He actually is an Arch-Druid in some sort of, Wiccan religion or something. And he writes very interesting stuff. And he points out that, you know, for a big population collapse, where you say the population gets reduced by a third in just a number of years, it doesn't require big massacres or big die-offs. Just a little, a change in the birth rate every year that kind of accumulates. And so, populations can shrink. They really can. And John Michael Greer is really worth reading. He's got kind of a very ornate style of writing, but he's kind of an interesting guy.
Per Fogering is an interesting guy, and he's my guest here on The Beloved Community, talking about his novel, not only his novel, but a lot of things, Jack Maloney's Century from 1980 or so to 2080, and the life in America after peak oil. But we're going to take a phone call, and we've got Dennis on the line. Dennis, are you there?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Listen, the question I have to Per is I understand that he knew Mike Brubart. Mike Brubart's name came up on this program. I was wondering how your lives intersected with your life intersected with Mike Brubart. And what kind of a guy was he? And I don't understand why he committed suicide. That's what I heard.
Well, yeah, I think I first ran across.
Thank you, Dennis.
I read some of his articles, and then this was years ago. He put on a kind of a thing down in Eugene at the county fairgrounds there, sort of a seminar or a big discussion going on, and then he had his newsletter
From the Wilderness.
From the Wilderness, right? It was really good stuff, and then I had him as a guest on my show a few times, and he's done presentations here in Portland, and I don't know, he's a very interesting guy. I mean, He had his own kind of private demons, and which he wrote about himself, his own growing up was very troubled, and he became an L.A. cop, and he was on sort of anti-narcotics work, and he found out that his fiancée, she was working for the CIA and actually enabling drugs to come into this country. And it's kind of ended their romance, And, Mike Rupert, I mean,
he whistleblowed on that, too. I mean, he went up and
I think he
went
pretty
far on that.
He put his life in danger. Mm-hmm. And he left the L.A. police force. He kind of made his living as a writer and lecturer and stuff. And in some ways, he's a very driven guy, but I think he was really very honest. He really he's determined to uncover the truth about what's going on in the world.
Yeah, Crossing the Rubicon was his big book. I mean, about 700 pages, and then he had a movie, a documentary, which was kind of interesting, called Collapse, about him and his life, and that's kind of where he went with the end. But he it was after 9/11, and he came and did something at Portland State. I mean, just a couple of months, and I saw your name on the credits there. I think you helped to bring him when he did his program about regarding his criticism of 9/11.
Yeah, I think, I still have got to read the Crossing the Rubicon, but apparently he doesn't really spend much time with the idea that the buildings were wired to collapse. You know, he sort of, I don't think he takes any position on that at all, but he says that you can show that this was a set-up job just by the fact that the way the Air Force planes were programmed.
Right.
You know, they were doing all these training exercises that got in the way of tracking down the planes that were hijacked. And this is all apparently all the work of Dick Cheney. He was the one who oversaw all that. And Mike Rupert says that that this is sort of the proof that the 9/11 was kind of a.
He wanted to put Dick Cheney on the spot there. Means motive and opportunity is what he was making his case against Cheney. Yeah. Dennis, thanks. Thanks for the call. I want to talk with you, Pear, a little bit about technology and it's coming back. And that's what I found in your book, that a lot of the things that were kind of that people had done before are learning to do. And we've forgotten how to do anything, haven't we? I mean, just even within the last 20 years, I mean, I look at people, well, we'll just go back to doing this or that. But I don't think anybody knows how to do anything except work their phones.
What happens when the phones don't work?
That's it.
You know, a lot of people would be frantically trying to connect with dead phones in their hands.
Right.
You know, in fact, I got this novel I'm working on now. There's this one little very brief scene in a department store where they have a big bin with dead phones, and people are frantically picking them up and poking them to see if there's any life in these dead phones, you know. But anyway, you know, technology changes to suit what is available as far as energy and resources. You know, you can't have an auto economy when there's no cheap oil. You have to have something else. Well, you can have electric cars, you can have bicycles, you can have one thing or another, but
but you also got to produce them, and what's it going to take?
Well,
right?
That's very interesting too. Yeah, but I think air travel is on its way out. Already now, you know, it's very expensive. It's a horrible way to travel anyway. I hate flying.
You feel like a prisoner.
Yes, you are. You are. You're crammed into a little flying tube, and they're figuring out ways to cram more and more, I don't know, by reducing the seat space and just sort of stacking people up. I mean, it's weird. I would not fly unless I absolutely had to.
We've turned into just these docile people. I just got on a flight and I came back, and just this is just how silly all of this going through all of the security stuff is, because the line got so heavy. It was in Newark, and so the line's so heavy with people or whatever, so the TSA guy just says, "Oh, come on through." I mean, so you know it's just all phony having you go in there and getting your picture taken and all of that kind of stuff, because they know they're just wasting time. Anyway, that's my opinion. But I want to talk about war and anti-war and the Pentagon budget, and we've got about 5 minutes left. But is there an anti-war movement left? I mean, I can't believe it when Democrats outvote Republicans in supporting Pentagon budgets.
That is very interesting. You know, I think the sort of the centrist Democrats now are sort of, they follow in this line of succession. You remember Henry Scoop Jackson, senator from Washington State? He was kind of a liberal at home, you know. He was a good Democrat and everything, but he was a Cold Warrior. He really was. And I think that's what you've got now. You've got, you know, the Democrats or the whole Clinton crowd, you know, they are liberal and they're progressive on a lot of issues at home. But when it comes to war, they've got a real grudge against Russia. And this is my big fear, is that when and if Trump is out of office, that these people will take over and they will pick up where they left off. When last heard from, you know, they'd overthrown a legal elected government in Ukraine, you know, which had all sorts of repercussions, which we gripe about, like Crimea, you know, in the secession movement in eastern Ukraine. But it's, you know, these Cold War Democrats are kind of, they will inherit the White House, unless some of the more progressive people, younger people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the other people can somehow change the party. I don't know if that'll happen or not. We can hope, but you know. And so, for some reason, a lot of Republicans are kind of anti-war. Well, some of them, you know, like Pat Buchanan, who I disagree mm-hmm. with in almost everything I could think of, but on war and peace issues, he's not bad. Read some of his articles, you know. And maybe they're called isolationists, but you know, you find this weird situation where liberals are in favor of wars, and some of the Republicans are more in favor of peace, unless they have their own. You know, Trump's enemy is Iran and China, where the Democrats seem to want to go after Russia more. So they have different enemies, you know.
Right.
It's a weird situation.
You know, it's interesting. Just the other day, I was speaking of Pepe Escobar, and he posted on his Facebook page, tweet from Trump. And the tweet from Trump is this, that came out the other day. It says, the United States has spent $8 trillion fighting and policing in the Middle East. Thousands of our great soldiers have died and been badly wounded. Millions of people have died on the other side. Going into the Middle East is the worst decision ever made in the history of our country. We went to war under a false and now disproven premise, weapons of mass destruction. There were none. Now we're slowly and carefully bringing our great soldiers and military home. Our focus is on the big picture. The USA is greater than ever before. Now that is Donald Trump, and Pepe Escobar says this has got to be one of the most explosive outbursts ever by a POTUS, no less. When Trump tweets truth, yes, it does happen. It's always astonishing.
Well, that's true. You know, if you didn't know who, if you didn't have a signature below that tweet, you'd think that was some rational person, you know?
No, I have no idea what's the motive behind that guy for saying those things. You know, I don't know. It's just really an incredible puzzle. But the idea of war and peace, thinking, well, we finally get rid of Bush, then we'll have peace. But it wasn't like that at all. Obama just bombed people just as much as anybody.
Well, he did. I had a guy on my show not too long ago, Jeremy Kuzmarov, wrote a book about, Obama's Endless Wars. And he goes into them. That's a very interesting book. I recommend it. But I don't know. It's
I could have 10 shows with you, Pear. We've got a lot to talk about, and I really appreciate that you are here at KBOO and have been here for a long time, a warrior for peace. His book, if you haven't picked it up, his novel is called Jack Maloney's Century, and it traces 80 years into the future. And possibilities for how human beings. Actually, it's a very optimistic novel, I think. There's a lot of love in there. You even have some sex scenes. And so it is Pear Fogering, Jack Maloney. Yeah, a last word, Pear, before we go.
Kind of got a nice cover too. Hey, I did the cover myself with colored pencil, but it shows the U.S. Capitol and the Washington Mall, which is flooded. And here's a guy sitting in this little rowboat fishing on the mall in front of the U.S. Capitol. So kind of a pretty picture in a way, you know.
That's right. Pear Fogering has been my guest on the Beloved Community. Catch the Beloved Community every second Friday from 9 to 10. And you can catch Pear Fogering's show, Fight the Empire, on first and third Thursday mornings mm-hmm. at 9:30. And until next time, I'm John Shuck. Be well.
Find out his name and then KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Resilience in Action, a fundraiser of Living Yoga on Saturday, October 19th at 4:30 p.m. at the Eleanor in Portland. Living Yoga's mission is to foster healing and resilience through trauma and